This is Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Carol Masser. Welcome to the Bloomberg Business Week weekend podcast. In this episode, we'll bring you news of the week, insights from the magazine, and a lot more.
We're going to look at recession. Kind of hard to call, Carol.
It is. Economists have a tough time with this, and they do because of... Jason, because of many reasons.
We're also going to look at executive privilege. It's at the core of what happens next post-Mueller.
Plus, taking a look at those big unicorns. We're talking about those companies, those stocks expected to come to market, Jason, with a billion-plus market cap. It's this week's cover story. Does it show that maybe we're getting to the end of this bull market?
Is the thundering herd leading us to the brink of recession? All right. But first, Carol, it was the Bloomberg Equality Summit this week. We were busy taking part of it. Really so interesting, so thought-provoking. Featured some of the biggest names in business, finance, and politics.
And this hour, Jason, we're going to bring you some of our favorite conversations from that event.
That's right. First up, a really fun chat with movie producer Will Packer. He is living in the ATL right now. We talked a little bit about that. We also talked about diversity in movie making, how to change the narrative in Hollywood. It feels like that's starting to happen. Here's the conversation.
So, you know, it's interesting. I just came off of a lunch here at the Equality Summit with CEOs, and we were talking about the importance of diversity. And one of the things that came up is they said the way women and African-Americans and minorities and LGBT community is represented in either media or in the entertainment world, that it's got to get better.
Yeah. But you know what? It's ultimately an economic decision. That's the thing that I say to people all the time. You know, Hollywood's a business. I am a filmmaker. I'm a producer. I am a businessman. And so what happens is that you are seeing, and I am an example of it, you are seeing projects that are more inclusionary, that have more diverse voices, that have multiple entry points for audiences, that look more like the global community. They're making more money than ever before.
Right.
And so it feels like if you have content that is not representative of the world, it starts to feel dated. It starts to feel like something that's not as hip and as edgy and as provocative and as of the moment. And that's what audiences are gravitating to. So I tell people all the time, it's just good business.
Right.
It's good business to make sure that you've got content that feels like the world we live in.
Listen, I think we have some examples for the past few years that you have worked on to point to. Girls Trip being, I think, a great example of that.
Yeah.
I mean, that I think we'll look back and see that film, among a few others over the last couple of years, whether it's Get Out, whether it's Black Panther,
right,
that really sort of opened people's eyes to, as you say, listen, economically, this makes sense.
Makes
you want to get to an audience, you want to make some money, here you go.
There you go. You make it for a particular number. You aim at an audience, which is what we all do as filmmakers and content creators, and then you expand beyond that core audience, right? And
so why do you think that particular movie resonated the way that it did?
Girls Trip? You know what? Because it was an inclusionary story. It was a universal theme. It didn't feel exclusive. You didn't feel like, okay, I'm not in on the joke if I don't necessarily look like the actors in it, right? It was about, you know, four women behaving badly, having fun on Bourbon Street. Who hasn't done that, right?
Yeah.
I don't care what you look like, you know.
So listen, I can tell that you value the platform that you have. There's
something
that just debuted on Discovery, and this is about the Atlanta child murders.
Yeah.
Tell me about that, because, you know, you brought attention to something that didn't get a lot of attention initially.
Yeah. You know what? It's interesting because I've had a lot of success with comedies. I've executive produced Straight Outta Compton and some thrillers, and nothing with this level of seriousness and this gravity. But I have a responsibility to tell stories and choose what stories I tell. And I said, I've got to tell this story because so many people don't know it, right? Some people do, but by and large, it's not something that is looked at as one of the great American tragedies, which it really was. You had these, you know, 23 kids who were murdered in Atlanta over the course of a 2-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody has been tried for their murders. A person who was tried for other murders of two adults that happened around that time. And then they closed all the cases. And a lot of people think it was for a matter of convenience. convenient. So anyway, when I had the opportunity to be a part of this, I said, yeah, absolutely. This is what I should be doing,
right,
is bringing a platform to something like this, and I'm very happy.
But it speaks to a larger point, right, that people who have platforms, whether you're a CEO, whether you're a president, whether you're a senator, whether you're a producer in the entertainment industry, you do have a responsibility to kind of push the conversation, get the real conversations out there.
I certainly think so. I mean, you know, listen, at the end of the day, we all operate under this economic imperative, and that's something that you cannot forget. But there is a this is a responsibility, right? This is a privilege to do what we do and to be working in media and to be, you know, controlling what people consume. And so you just have to be responsible about that and the narratives that you choose to push to the front.
All right, 30 seconds. Give us a little, let's finish where we start with a shout out to the ATL.
ATL,
so much happening down there.
Oh,
why?
Man.
Why
you
is
know,
it just
Atlanta's
fire
become,
like this?
I mean, you know, we call it on-location filming. It's the number one on-location filming market in the country right now, which, you know, it like excludes like stages and all that. But you know what? Because we've got a great tax incentive down there, and it is a place where if you look at a, like almost every third movie that is released or television show is shot in Atlanta.
Yeah.
It's a great environment. You know that, Jason.
I know,
you
it's
were
amazing.
There. My
it's
next
amazing.
Movie is was shot there. It's called Little. It's dropping on April 12th.
April 12th. Yeah.
Wow.
Check that out.
Spread that in.
And you've got like 18
this
seconds
guy knows
to
what
go.
He's doing.
Yeah, well.
Holy moly.
Thanks for having me, guys. Right. This is an important conversation to have.
No,
it's great.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And we really
kudos
appreciate
to you
your
guys.
Time.
You know what? Giving somebody like me a platform to talk about these kind of things. It's good.
That's movie producer Will Packer. What a fun conversation. You can tell that guy's a movie maker.
He is a movie maker. And what I love about it reminded me of when we were in Atlanta. There's so much going on in terms of the entertainment industry, the movie industry, and he's in the thick of it. Jason, we're going to continue looking back at the Bloomberg Equality Summit. It was held this week at Bloomberg headquarters.
A lot of buzz here in world headquarters. Great couple days. You caught up with Sly James. He's the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri.
We talked about diversity, housing and technology, and especially education.
Here's some of that conversation.
So when you first took office in 2011, I'm curious, what were the inequalities, Mayor James, that you faced, that bothered you, that disturbed you the most?
I had the great pleasure of, within a month of being inaugurated, a little more than a month being inaugurated, I was in Baltimore for my first U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting. And at that meeting, I met Ralph Smith of the Annie Casey Foundation in grade level reading. And he really did educate me about the absolute importance of third grade reading proficiency and what it meant to a child's academic life and to their life thereafter. So when I came back to Kansas City, we have 15 school districts in whole or in part in Kansas City. It's a ridiculous number. And we took a data dump of what was going on with third grade reading. And on average, it was 33.8% proficient third grade readers, but in the—
One third. Yeah.
And in the predominantly African American school district, the namesake school district, it was 19%. And what drove me nuts was that nobody was upset about it. Hmm. You know, so I thought that it fit right with my personality. I have this marvelous ability to upset people. So I went about doing my job.
I just love that. That's a bumper sticker.
So we started Turn to Page KC with the goal of trying to get all children reading proficiently at third grade, regardless of zip code, age, color, socioeconomics. And over the years that we've been doing it now, almost 8 years, it's a collective impact model. We work with a ton of groups. We've managed to get that 33.8% up to 55%. But still, the predominantly African-American school district is lagging far behind their suburban, more suburban type peers. So now what we're pushing is early pre-K, because the bottom line is kids born in poverty hear 30 million words fewer than their middle income peers by the time they're 3 years old.
30 million fewer words. Right.
That's an enormous amount of not talking and people not socializing children. Not necessarily because they're mean or evil. Sometimes they don't know the importance. Sometimes they're busy trying to make a living. Their hierarchy of needs may be different.
So here at Bloomberg, we like to keep some data. So I wanted to just show the impact of some of the seeds that Mayor James has sown. And one we have on the percentage of people living below the poverty level in Kansas City, it's been declining since 2014.
Doesn't feel like it.
Doesn't feel like
No, and it doesn't feel like it because there's still way too many people who are living below the poverty level. And some
what holds most of them back? Because you talk so much, of course, about education. Got to start young. But what is it?
Our education system has failed generations of people. And those people, because their educations have failed them, don't necessarily put the same emphasis on it for their children. But the school districts haven't changed. The methods of teaching haven't changed. It's the same old, and somehow expecting a different result. So I think that's one of the problems. I think there is also institutionalized racism that definitely has an impact. I think that there are places, Kansas City, frankly, is a segregated city. Mm-hmm. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of Urban Land Institute. And one of the people that founded Urban Land Institute, he also was responsible for segregating the city by putting covenants in real estate contracts that kept minorities in a certain part of town and others out.
It's not a new problem, though, and you've had it 8 years. What do you feel like has made the biggest impact on improving an individual, an African-American's economic situation in your city?
We've been very diligent and intentional about skilling people up after the recession, trying to get them into new areas of work. We've been very intentional about trying to do some things in the community that would generate jobs and economic activity. We've been very intentional about putting money into the community in terms of infrastructure, which would then allow businesses to come in and operate. And we've been very intentional about focusing on kids in school, and in the process of doing that, drawing parents into that conversation, which has helped somewhat.
How did you prioritize these kinds of things? Safety, education, affordable housing, jobs. You were looking at all of this stuff. How'd you prioritize it? Because that's a pretty full plate.
Well, my agenda was a 4-year agenda: education, governmental efficiency, enforcement of the laws, and employment.
So we categorized
the 4E agenda. But if I had to pick one thing that I would focus on, I would go for education. Because I think that if you have education, if we instill education and make high quality education available to everybody, I mean, really, how many times do you see PhDs shooting master's degree candidates on a street corner? You just don't.
I do know. I now know what you're doing after you're out of mayor's office. You've got a circuit,
writing
right? A comedy circuit.
but
you're right. Right?
Education,
for the most part,
education is a great equalizer to the extent that you have equalizers. It's one of those things that gets you past the door. It gives you options. You don't have to necessarily be engaged in risky behavior if you have a good education. You have more options than if you don't. Our problem is that we have too many people who have had failing educational outcomes. And because of that, we have a higher level of crime. The earlier chart that showed the level of black versus non-black involvement in crime, there's another overlay to that, and that is location. Mm-hmm. Because crime is, some of our crime is disproportionately located in areas where there is poverty, which are almost per se people of color. And in a 13 square mile area in a city that is 318 square miles, which is pretty big, 5 San Francisco's fit in Kansas City, we have about 70% of all the homicides and gun violence in that one area. And guess where it is? In the place where there's the lowest educational attainment, where there's the lowest median income, where there's the highest rate of poverty and assistance needed, where there is just about every negative thing that you can say is concentrated there. And when you have people who are trapped in a hopeless and cycle, then they're going to do things they shouldn't do. If they can't get their own stuff, they're going to come and take yours.
That's Kansas City, Missouri Mayor Sly James. And Jason, what I love about these stories is so often you and I have conversations, and it's often at the macro level. This is somebody who's out there talking to folks in his city and just trying to tackle so many of the problems that they're facing.
Yeah, it's right there. They're really at ground level, and there are a lot of challenges, but you know, we'll see how it goes for him.
Exactly.
We continue this hour looking back at the Bloomberg Equality Summit held this week at Bloomberg headquarters.
And Jason, someone who we got the opportunity to speak to was Jill Faraday Lloyd. She's a managing director at Evercore Wealth Management. She talked about the next phase of the Me Too movement. Here's some of our conversation.
So where are we in this whole Me Too conversation? We're a year plus in. How would you describe where we are?
Well, from my perspective, I think it's a very exciting time, especially for women. And as we start to gain more power, as more women have positions of power in business and have more wealth, change is really starting to occur.
Follow the money, basically, right?
Well, it's an interesting statistic, and you may have heard it, but due to the fact that women get college degrees at faster rates than men, so 57% of undergraduates degrees go to women, 62% of postgraduate degrees are granted to women.
Wow.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that, actually.
40% of wives now already out-earn their husbands. But as we are getting educated faster, that number will be higher. It will be above 50% by the next generation. So we're not only generating our own wealth, but we're also inheriting at an unprecedented rate from our baby boomer parents and the fact that we outlive our husbands. Wives outlive husbands on average 15 years. So that by the year 2030, women will have two-thirds of the nation's wealth.
So what's that going to do to the financial industry?
Well, so...
Or what are they doing to plan for that?
There you are. That's a great question. So, I work at Evercore Wealth Management, which is a firm that has 50% of their senior professionals are women. It's a completely gender-balanced firm. And when I was interviewing with Jeff Maurer, who's our CEO, and I looked at his statistics, I said, oh my gosh, you've got 50% senior women, you've got 35% of the partners are women. You've got twice the industry average of portfolio managers that are women. Was this by design or was it dumb luck? And he just said, listen, I just hired the best people for the jobs. And that was such a rewarding thing to hear that
yeah.
He had me at hello and I wanted to join.
You know, it's interesting too. I keep going back to this lunch I had with CEOs and like, you know, we don't have a problem if you walk into a corporate board or a company and it's 60% men and 40% women or 70% men or whatever. But if we skewed it the other way, somebody talked about an example where their management team was predominantly women and somebody was like, don't you think that's like kind of sending a bad message? There's a problem with that? Like, I do wonder when we can, because like you're talking about the amount of money that women will be making in the future, probably managing and investing, right? Their
Correct.
Own money that they're making. Like, it sounds like you should even be skewing the numbers more favorable towards women.
Well, I've made the conscious decision and the commitment to focus just on predominantly on women clients.
Yeah.
So they're executives, they're entrepreneurs, they're philanthropists. And one of the questions in the panel was, do you have mentors? How do you find mentors as a woman on Wall Street? Well, first of all, my firm is diverse.
Yeah.
But second of all, these women who are my clients are outstanding. And as much as I help them fill in their investment gaps,
right.
they've become my mentors and friends. And because Wall Street's built on trust,
yeah.
as they've come to trust me to manage their money, then they've acted as sponsors for me. And
Which
they
is even
recommend,
more productive, right?
And then they recommend yeah. me to others, putting their reputations on the line.
So fair to say that it sounds like things are going well, trending right, and even historically at your firm. Can't say the same for a lot of the rest of Wall Street. Is there a reckoning coming? Is there some sort of flashpoint that will help the rest of Wall Street catch up?
I can only speak for Evercore. What I have to say to young women is that there are plenty of firms like mine
yeah.
where the tide has turned. And look to work for those places where it's led from the top down, where the culture is about equality, and where it's about the outcome for the client. And in this case, many of the clients are women.
What is your advice to women in this environment? What is your advice to men in this environment?
You know, I would just turn it back to, we're working together towards a new future, all of us. And some of us are looking at the future right now and saying, that's not the future I want. So it's about investing with your values, putting your money to work, voting with your wallet, investing in companies who are doing the right things for their employees, from a gender perspective, for the environment. It's about really leading, walking the talk.
That's Jill Faherty-Lloyd. She's managing director over at Evercore Wealth Management. And Carol, really interesting to think about what happens next in finance, given where we are in Me Too. It obviously bounced very high in the entertainment and media industries. Is the reckoning coming? here on Wall Street.
Right. And she talked a lot about women in the workforce, women making a lot of the money in their households, and ultimately they're going to be investing it. We continue this hour looking back at the Bloomberg Equality Summit. It was held this week at Bloomberg headquarters in New York.
And Carol, one of the people I got to catch up with was John Winkelried. He's the co-CEO of TPG, worked at Goldman Sachs for a time as well. And he's got a lot on his plate these days, most notably dealing with the aftermath of that college admissions scandal.
And Jason, that conversation you had was one of the most read stories on the Bloomberg terminal. Here's some of what he had to say.
Let's start on the news, as we do here at Bloomberg. A couple weeks ago, one of your partners, Bill McGlashan, was wrapped up in this now very well-known admission scandal. You guys, I think it's fair to say, move swiftly, both internally and externally. I want to ask you where you stand now with your investors, because notably one of the decisions you made was to go to investors in the new Rise Fund and say, look, it's all good. Can have your money back if you want. How have they reacted? And then I want to talk to you about what's going on inside the firm.
Well, I think a couple of weeks ago when this news first broke, it was as you might imagine, it was pretty shocking. I mean, this is something that we had no knowledge of or had no idea this was all happening. And so anytime something like this happens, you know, you sort of, it takes your breath away for a minute. But we, you know, we reacted as you described. I mean, we tried to react, you know, pretty, in a pretty focused way. And, one of the things that I think we felt was really important to do was to make sure that we were communicating. And so we went out to all of our stakeholders. And by the way, that's both externally in terms of our investors, our LPs, and also internally, because this is obviously a very important thing internally as well with all our people. But our investors, I would say overall, number one, are very supportive, and they obviously understood the context that, unfortunately, Bill was engaged in this scheme on a personal basis, and so our investors, number one, were very supportive. Our investors understand what we're trying to accomplish as a firm with respect to the franchise that Bill was part of, which is our growth equity franchise, and also, importantly, our impact franchise, which obviously has a lot to do with why we're here today, but naturally have a lot of questions. They have a lot of questions. And so what we've committed to our investors is that we've undertaken an investigation internally to make sure that none of the things that Bill was engaged in were in any way, shape, or form bleeding into the business. We owe that to our investors, and so we're working on that. We're going to go back to them and give them a readout when we're done with that and when we finished with all of our work. And importantly, also, I think our investors understand that, you know, our growth and our Rise Impact franchise, you know, we're talking about 100 people, 100 plus people. We have a deep, broad team. We have our impact fund has now made close to 30 investments, over about $1.1 billion of capital. And so when you actually look at the companies we've invested in and the work these companies are doing, I think they all realize that there is a bigger, there's something bigger here than just one individual. So they're very constructive. You referenced giving, you know, us allowing them to take their money back. What we did, we were beginning to raise the second fund.
Right.
So we had done a first close, and we went back to our investors and said, of course, you'll have an opportunity to reevaluate.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody is comfortable with where we are right now. We'll have a readout ultimately of our internal work, and you know, then we'll go forward from there.
So, help us understand this in the broader context of the work that you are doing inside TPG around diversity and inclusion. This is something that you really personally have taken on since you arrived just a few years ago, and we can go back to your history at Goldman as well. But
yep.
But I do want to understand the current context and how. Not just this latest news mm-hmm. and the McGlashan situation, but more generally, what moment are you at in your work internally?
Well, I think the broader context of why I feel it's so important and why I think why we feel it's so important is because it's not just a question of diversity is one aspect of it. I like to view it as a much broader context. In the world that we live in today, being a fiduciary, investing on behalf of the stakeholders that we invest on behalf of, and also having an organization that people feel they really want to be part of, it's really important, in my view, that you have that there's some expression of values. Like, what do you stand for as a company? What's important to you? What are you trying to accomplish? So it's not just diversity is one part of it. You know, I like to start more from the perspective of what's sort of your values as an organization? How do you think about, just in the normal course of your investing activities, how do you think about what we're doing, why we're doing it? I like to think about the environment at the firm. I start with kind of inclusivity, and then that bleeds into the whole idea of diversity. Are we an organization where people feel like they really want to be part of this kind of living, breathing organism that is our that is a firm? And so I feel like when I got to the firm, I think that we were sort of in the beginning stages of sort of getting our heads around that. And I think in the past couple of years in particular, I think this whole concept of sort of value orientation, what do you stand for? What are you trying to accomplish? I think that has accelerated in a big way, not just at TPG, just generally in the market.
Well, and I want to ask you about that, because I think it's fair to say, I don't think anyone in this room would disagree, this is not something private equity has been good at. It has been...
Really?
White, it's been male, it's been bros. So...
Bros?
Bros. Yeah. So why, like, first of all, I mean, briefly, why? And second, do you have a legitimate shot at changing that narrative quickly?
Well, first of all, why is because I think, well, first of all, it's important to me. I think that when you are part of an organization, and I learned this a little bit in my past organization at Goldman Sachs, I mean, when you're part of an organization that is white, bro, homogeneous, you know, and then you have a set of experiences where you kind of get out of that atmosphere, you realize the difference. You realize the richness of being in a much more heterogeneous environment. You realize the richness of having a bunch of different type of people sitting around. Some of it's subtle, but some of it's not that subtle, okay, in terms of the idea flow, who you connect with externally, you know, and again, going back to kind of what you stand for. So I feel like it makes you a much better, much richer, much more interesting organization. And your ability in our world, where you're trying to actually invest in companies, you're trying to relate to and connect to CEOs, or you're trying to relate to that are running other companies. You're trying to relate to companies that are prosecuting businesses where they're dealing in a diverse world. I think having an understanding having a connection in some way, shape, or form, because your organization is trying to do some of the same things, to me, that's a very important thing. So I think that, so just kind of level setting, I think it's very important in that respect. In terms of changing it fast, I think it depends on what your definition of fast is. Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at...
Well, because your LPs have made it clear that this is something that's very important to them,
I think if you look at what we looked like, I've been there for a little over 3.5 years. If I use that as a frame of reference, if you look at where we were 3.5 years ago versus where we are today, I think we have moved the needle a lot. Do we have to move it a lot more? We do. But I think we've moved it a lot. Just give you some examples. I mean, you know, we have focused on creating an environment that is more inclusive and people feel more comfortable, and things like we have done as an example. We just changed our family leave policy. Our family leave policy is gender blind. It's 18 weeks for the primary caregiver. It's 4 weeks for the secondary caregiver. You can take 4 of those weeks at any time during the course of the year. We have undertaken a program and we think about this, by the way, with respect to our broader ecosystem, not just the 1,000 people at TPG. We have investments in almost 250 companies. Of those 250 companies, we are actually on the board, and in some cases control, in some cases don't control, but have influence. A year ago, we set out to change the composition of our boards for every single company where we have control or significant influence from a gender and diversity perspective. As an example, in the last year, we have made, we've changed the board gender composition in over 30 of our companies, and we're going to continue until we've basically touched them all. And in the process of doing that, I'll give you an example of sort of the importance of this kind of the network effect of this. In the process of doing that, we put together a listing of women who could serve on boards. Believe it or not, there's 600 women on that list that we have, through our network, have connected to and basically are really incredible people who could play some kind of role in helping us govern our companies.
And that's John Winkelried, the co-CEO of TPG. And Carol, what I found interesting was certainly acknowledging a lot of the challenges that private equity faces. This was, for a long time, a very insular industry, mm-hmm. small, tight, and candidly, as you heard us talk about, very white and very male. They're trying to change that, and they're trying to change it in part because they're getting a lot of pressure from their own investors.
Yeah, very revealing conversation.
So what's next when it comes to the Mueller report, both the mechanics of it, but also the politics? Jillian Goodman down in D.C. has all of that, all of those answers, but there aren't a lot of answers as of yet, Jillian, right?
That's correct. Yeah, not so much.
And so let's start with this notion of executive privilege, because it has been thrown about many times over the course of this 22 months that we've been watching this investigation go on. How might that play into the equation now that the report has at least been delivered to justice?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Trump is in a really interesting position here in that on the one hand, he was the subject of this 22-month investigation, but now he is the only one who gets to decide what parts of that, you know, what parts of what was provided to the investigators are and aren't covered by executive privilege. And now, you know, he got up in front of reporters on Monday, I believe, and said, you know, he doesn't care, you know, as long as the attorney general's okay, let it all come out. But there are plenty of reasons why, you know, even beyond anything, you know, in particular that he's worried about, you know, having been said or having been discovered, that they wouldn't want some of those things to come out. Jay Sekulow was also talking to reporters about how, you know, if they released his interview questions, that would set a difficult precedent for future presidents, for example.
And so, as you say, Trump ultimately decides. Do you have a sense of where justice is leaning? Because you have an interesting cast of characters there. You have Attorney General Barr, who was appointed by the president after he dismissed Jeff Sessions, the former attorney general, who the president obviously made his displeasure well known. There you have Rod Rosenstein, who I guess is hanging around for a certain amount of time. Ultimately, the president is, as they say, the decider. But what sort of advice do you think he's going to be getting?
I mean, you know, from his own lawyers, obviously, like they probably would not want that much of, you know, what they provided to the investigators to come out. As far as from the justice standpoint, I mean, part of the attorney general's job is to make sure that executive privilege is protected. On the other hand, you know, Barr has said repeatedly that he wants to make as much of the report public as possible. Of course, that as possible, you know, is sort of a big effective if in this scenario, because there are plenty of things that he won't be able to disclose because of regulations covering, you know, secrecy around grand jury proceedings, other ongoing investigations. You know, he's been vocal about, you know, people are calling for him to release, you know, the full report, or at least a redacted version of the full report. He said he does not intend to do that. And so, you know, it's been kind of hard to pin down Barr on, you know, exactly what we can expect from the Justice Department on this.
Well, and one of the interesting elements certainly around Attorney General Barr is this notion that he wrote this long memo about what he essentially thought of this investigation and specifically around the question of obstruction of justice. So we know a little bit at least of what his thinking was before. Is there any sense that that has changed, and how much may he be called to account by folks on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue up on Capitol Hill as to what he should and shouldn't do?
Right. That memo is going to make it a lot harder for him to, you know, appease Democrats on this question. He hasn't said anything other than what's in his Sunday memo, but he will be coming before some House members on the Appropriations Subcommittee on April 9th for a previously scheduled hearing about his departmental budget. And that hearing is likely not just to be about his budget. You know, he's likely to get questions there about what, if anything, Congress will be able to see. So we should know more at that point. Hopefully.
And do you have any sense of what the timing is when some larger group of people will see some larger version of this report? Because at this point, you know, we should remind people at this point in the conversation, you know, very, very few people have seen the whole enchilada.
Right, exactly. I mean, Barr has said that he intends to take weeks, not months, to complete his review of the report to see what he could potentially release. Now, whether he decides to release that to Congress or Congress decides to release that, or excuse me, decides to release that to the public, or whether Congress decides to release it to the public, I mean, all of those questions are still out there.
And so let's talk about the politics of all of this, because this has been a fascinating week to watch everybody kind of dance around. Everybody did their probably fairly predictable things when we first got that report, that four-page report that you mentioned from Attorney General Barr. But then the politics changed a little bit, even over the course of the first few days of this week. Talk to us about what the president did, what the Republicans did, and then the Democrats.
Sure. I mean, you know, Trump is calling this a complete and total exoneration. He wants the full report to be released. Democrats are in a little bit of a tricky spot because they've started all of these investigations into the president that now, you know, Republicans are going to try and say, you know, the Mueller report has already exonerated the president. Why are you continuing to persecute him? You know, Democrats obviously want to, you know, sort of fulfill their investigatory duty under the Constitution and also to their constituents. You know, a big chunk of the Democratic base still wants to see him impeached, or at least did as of a couple weeks ago. But on the other hand, Democrats in Congress don't want to risk fatiguing voters and distracting from the issues that got them their House majority back in the first place in the midterms last November, which are, you know, especially health care. With the Trump administration in the last couple of days has come out again attacking the Affordable Care Act, which is sort of a gift to House Democrats, or would be if they could avoid getting distracted in, you know, investigating the president further.
That's Jillian Goodman speaking to me from Washington. I tell you, the twists and turns over the last 22 months, more to come.
Yeah, exactly. This story is far from over.
Lots of questions out there about what someone or some group knows about the equity market that the rest of us don't. That includes the famed upstarts with $1 billion plus valuations. It's called the unicorns, or the so-called unicorns. Let's get into it. Someone who covers the markets very closely for us, our own Mike Regan. It is our U.S. cover in the magazine this week. What are you looking into?
Well, as you said, there's this strange phenomenon that happens in markets somewhere where whatever the price action is, there's this assumption that someone knows something that everyone doesn't know. So I really got that sense in the past week or so.
It's very true right now.
It's
right?
Very true, because
coming off the Fed meeting, and
the Fed surprised people by basically in their projections for rate increases for the rest of the year. They basically are projecting no more rate increases. And so people think the Fed knows something we don't know. And, you know,
something bad. Right.
Right. something bad is coming. Then not too long after that, the 3-month 10-year yield curve inverted. And, you know, basically that's when rates on 3-month treasuries are higher than rates on 10-year treasuries, which without getting into all the bond market math, just is a worrisome sign.
It's not the way it's supposed to be in terms of the yield curve, right?
Right. You're supposed to get compensated for taking on a longer period of risk.
Right.
So if you're going to, you know, invest in a bond that matures in 10 years, the idea is that you get paid more. When those yields come down, it means people are really buying them heavily. And the thinking is that people are worried about the near term, about either recession or the deflationary environment, something that is going to drive bond prices higher and those yields lower. So they're willing to sort of, you know, get out of riskier assets and pile into that longer dated bond.
Well, and the thing is, Mike, and you know this so well, is that we're like, is the equity market right? Or does the bond market know something? And that's what we're all like.
The eternal struggle of who knows, who knows something
who's
the other doesn't
right.
And who's right. And so the cover and the story then really discusses these unicorns, all the big startups that are finally, after years of anticipation, coming to the public markets. So Lyft being being a good example, and its competitor Uber waiting in the wings. That'll be the big gorilla IPO of the year. But there's a bunch of others, obviously. I mean, Airbnb is expected. The list goes on and on. You can read the story for the list. I'm sure everyone knows a lot of what they are.
Well, some of the names we've been talking about, right? Pinterest all of a sudden came out. You mentioned Airbnb, Postmates, Slack. I mean, there's a slew of them. We talked about it in 2018. We said, okay, this could be a big year for IPOs, and we're starting to see that happen.
And it is. And the projections are sort of written in pencil when being erased and revised higher, I think, to the point of Renaissance Capital is a firm that specializes in IPO research, and they have an ETF that tracks IPOs. They're, thinking maybe $100 billion in IPOs this year, which would put it, if not a record, if it's a little above that, close to a record pace. That much issuance of new stock makes people nervous for a variety of reasons. One of them being someone knows something that we don't know. In other words,
like, why is everybody running to go public?
Right. You know, and there's often a lot of, you know, conspiracy theory, for lack of a better words, that sweeps through the market that, well, their bankers must be whispering in their ears that, you know, this is it. This is the time to sell now because the market is looking like it's getting top heavy. That, you know, as the bond yield inversion shows, there could be a recession in sometime in the not too distant future. This stock market rally has gone on for a decade. It's the longest we've seen, you know, depending on how you measure it. The economic expansion is almost unprecedented at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everyone will tell you, well, bull markets, economic expansions, they don't die of old age, but...
Wish I had a nickel for every time.
Right. But, you know, it still makes you wonder, anything that's gone on this long. So all of these companies picking this moment in time to tap into the public stock markets is making people nervous that a top is at hand.
Well, you got to add on top of that, right? This was not a tech unicorn, but Levi Strauss, you know, an old brand name. It was, you know, a private company, had some troubles. It went public. It had a good IPO. So anybody who's considering an IPO has to say, wow, look at how that one was received.
True.
And, in the marketplace. You know,
right. Not exactly an upstart unicorn, but as I wrote, it is a San Francisco innovator from years past.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you have to make some tenuous connection. But, you know, you're right. And there's a long list of potential IPOs this year. And
the thing is, Mike, if you're going to do an IPO, right, you want to do it in a market that's a friendly one.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
So that it's well received.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's case to be made. This is the perfect environment from the perspective of the investors, the private investors, mm-hmm. and all these companies. Stocks are high, volatility, you know, we had that nasty fourth quarter, but it's kind of calmed down. The problem is the last few major market tops before bear markets, 2007, 1999, 2000, they were both marked by very hyperactive IPO markets and a lot of issuance. Same kind of thinking. What better time is there to go public?
But it is different in that Lyft and Uber, I mean, these are companies that have been around for years. Back in 99, 2000, you had companies that had just started up, right? And then went public pretty quickly, just threw .com on their name, and they seemed to go public very quickly. These are companies, although not necessarily profitable,
well,
but they've been around for a while.
Yeah, still been around for a while. Obviously have a very strong tangible asset, customer base.
Yeah.
Look like potentially great companies, not profitable yet, you know, pretty cutthroat competition in a lot of these unicorns. So You know, it's hard for me to fall on one side or the other of, like, this is a concrete signal. I think two instances, 1999 and 2007, you know, is not enough of a historical data set to say absolutely. I don't think – and the point I kind of – not to give a spoiler alert to what the story concludes is that anyone who looks for sort of a foolproof sign of a market top and a time to get out is kind of foolish. I think I made the joke. That's the true unicorn is a foolproof signal that the market is about to reach a top just because it doesn't exist.
So that's Mike Regan. And Jason, you know, he follows the stock market for us so closely. And I think we've all been trying to figure out what's a smart signal to follow that this is the end of the bull market. And could it be all of those tech IPOs, those companies, those startups with $1 billion plus market valuation coming to market, finally public market? Could that be a sign of the end?
We talk all the time about following the money. Apparently, it's about following the unicorns.
So, fun story this week from our economics editor, Peter Coy, or maybe not, considering the questionable time we are when it comes to the U.S. economy. We're all asking recession or no recession. Peter asks, why are economists so bad at predicting recessions? Let's bring him in. He's our economics editor. His story, of course, in the economics section of the magazine. I feel bad for economists, right? Because we're like, why can't you get this right? It's not easy.
It's not easy. I wrote the story with Simon Kennedy. Actually, Simon Kennedy in London was the lead writer on it. It's not easy. That's, I think, the first thing you have to say. It's easy to laugh at economists for missing recessions or forecasting ones that never occur.
Yeah.
But if you think about weather forecasting, which has improved so much in recent decades.
Data's better.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Much better data. And you have a big advantage when you're forecasting the weather, which is that the molecules of air do not watch television to see what the meteorologist is saying about them, whereas investors do and consumers do. And you get this weird feedback.
It's a lot of content being pushed at them.
Right. You get a kind of a feedback where there's an interaction between what people think is going to happen and what they think other people think is going to happen. And it vastly complicates the job. It's not just like little atoms.
Maybe we just need robots and AI.
That could help.
Well, there's an interesting stat. You said, is it Fathom Consulting? Talk to us a little bit about what they found.
Right. That's what got us started on the story. The London-based economic consulting firm, Simon, found this. And out of like 468 or something recessions since 1988, they looked at how the International Monetary Fund did in predicting them. And the spring of the year before the recession hit, they found only four were predicted.
Calling for the recession.
And then when you get to the spring of the year in which the recession actually hit, so like it's like impending at that point, they got only 111, so that's still less than a quarter of them. Not a great track record.
And it's not just IMF.
Let's about not those, pick on the IMF.
Right, because when those IMF forecasts will often come out, we're like, yeah, okay, you know, they don't get it
right. IMF, you know, is a just a fine forecasting organization as good as anybody else. So they actually did they looked at private forecasters, sort of turned the table, and they found the private forecasters really didn't do any better.
Well, and let's not forget, right, the Great Recession.
Well, that's
how many
the
people
black
missed
mark,
it.
Right?
Yeah.
There were people who saw a recession coming, but I would venture to say that even among those who did see a recession coming, few had any idea how bad it would
be. The magnitude,
It was the worst since the Great Depression of the 1930s, and that was just really not on the cards for most forecasters.
Let's go through some of the things that you and Simon, put in your story. You talk about info about the economy. It's complete, right? And there's a lag to it.
Right. So you literally
backwards
can't tell what's happening. And when the data come in, they come in with a lag. And then you have the phenomenon that a recession can be caused by something happening in the financial markets. Mm-hmm. So if there's a panic, for example, stocks suddenly fall, that can affect the real economy by reducing people's confidence or making them feel less wealthy. And so I think we would all agree that panics are hard to forecast. So if the panic is causing recession, therefore the recession is going to be hard to forecast.
Right. It's not easy. Right. You also talk about – I thought this was fascinating. A lack of incentives may be to blame. Talk about that
one. Yeah. That's something that Simon wrote about, which is just the idea that if you're like an investor, then you have a strong money incentive to get this right. If you're an economist, maybe a little less so. Then you run into things like groupthink, which is that you don't want to go too far out on a limb, because if you predict a recession that nobody else is predicting and then you're wrong, it's looks bad. Vice versa, if you don't predict when other people are, that also looks bad. So it's safer to move with the herd. Now, I want to mention something else, though, which kind of cuts the other way. Which
I feel like
is,
it might be the Peter the Economist talking.
my insertion into the story is that, think about it. If you don't want to get caught, you know, naked, like failing to forecast a recession, then what you'll do is you'll say, yeah, there's a recession coming. Can't say exactly when. And you're eventually going to be right about that, because, yes, there will be a recession. So there's an old saying in forecasting, give a number or give a date, but just don't give both in the same sentence.
I love that, right? Right. How many times have I gotten that?
Right.
But you also say, if you can play it safe, predictions 18 to 24 months in the future, right?
Yeah, because that would be an example of like, kind of somewhere out there. Because history shows that in any given month,
right,
going back decades, there's been a recession in about 13% of the month. So, you know, the odds that you're going to be right go up as you push out that date.
And that's Peter Coy. And Carol, you and I both love him so much because he really goes underneath all the jargon and helps us understand the idiosyncrasies of the economics trade.
And he gives us a list of why it's so difficult for economists to predict that a recession is coming. So the Pursuit's opener this week's about all the cool new things that are going on in the ancient Japanese city of Kyoto, from art, culture, food. There's so much going on.
Yeah.
How come?
Well, everybody right now is thinking about cherry blossoms in Japan. And Kyoto is a place that you go to see that. It actually can be quite a mob scene. And we wanted to sort of focus on, okay, so when the cherry blossoms pass, like, what are you going to do in Kyoto? And actually, because of a lot of reasons, because there's a few new hotels opening up, because there's a great creative community there, because there's a lot of universities. And just because it's got a great history, there's actually a ton going on in Kyoto. And it's maybe the most exciting city in Japan right now.
It's fascinating because, right, everybody's focused on the upcoming Olympics and Tokyo,
yeah,
but
exactly.
Yet let's check out Kyoto. So what should I do? I've got a couple of days there. Where should I go? What should I do?
So you should stay in a fancy hotel.
Okay, done.
An Aman is opening there in November. The Park Hyatt, which is very famous in Tokyo, for Lost in Translation, it's
right.
Opening there. There's an Ace Hotel opening there. And then, you know, there's
$2,000 a night, though, in the Aman, right?
Yeah. All Amans are super expensive.
Okay.
And then there's these really crazy kaseki restaurants, which are, you know, it's like a meal in a very set order of dishes. And it's very traditional. And there's just, but there are these great restaurants that are sort of experimenting with it. So there's this restaurant called A Womb, which is hard to say.
Yeah.
Where it takes a whole kaseki meal and puts it on one bento platter. So you're getting the whole thing just in one plate. And we've got a great picture of it in the magazine.
It's gorgeous.
And then there's one called Monk, where it kind of messes with the kaseki tradition and actually puts like pizza in it. So there's food. And then you should definitely check out some of the cultural stuff. There's a photo festival called Kyotography.
Say that five times fast.
Yeah, which has been around for a few years now. And there's distilleries. Just all sorts of exciting stuff.
We'll talk about the distillery. I guess I didn't think about that, but yeah, there's beer.
Yeah, well, you know, it's actually spirits.
Or
so,
spirits,
you know,
forgive
whiskey,
me.
Japanese whiskey is
sake
a huge
brewing.
Thing. Yeah, there's sake. And then there's this super premium gin called Kinobi. And actually, gin is kind of becoming like a hot drink there. And it's in a lot of these new cocktail bars, which are also on the rise.
Talk to us, too, about, I guess, and it's easy to get in and out. It's funny, because I think we just take some of these cities for granted, but they do get a reboot, right?
Yeah. And it's and I think because Kyoto has such amazing history and it is so picturesque,
right,
with all the temples and the historic districts, people really don't think about what's fresh there. And that's actually, in addition to the amazing history, you know, really the reason to go right now.
All right, good stuff. So let's also talk about, let's go from Kyoto cool to shopping for cool supercars someone who apparently already owns a few and then signed some contracts on a few more.
This is such a great story. So the Geneva Motor Show recently happened, and a lot of auto shows now are kind of, the wind is kind of coming out of their sails. A lot of car companies don't go to all of them anymore because they can market in different ways. You know, they send their supercars to Pebble Beach or Amelia Island, or like a horse show.
Right, right.
And they kind of interact directly with their clients there.
But Geneva is still a big thing,
still,
right?
They debut major, major cars. It's very exciting. A bunch of our writers go. And this year, we tagged along with this guy, Chris Singh, who lives in Miami, and he's an investor. He inherited a bunch of money from a family company and just has made a lot
now
more.
Now he's spending it.
Now he's really good at spending it. He already owns a $1.5 million Pagani Zonda. He owns a $2.5 million Koenigsegg Agera RS and a $3.9 million Lambo Veneno.
Oh, I got those in my garage.
Yeah, right. So that's, you know, how much? $8, $7 million right there. And he walked around and he bought two cars on the show floor. And that's not exactly how those auto shows work. I mean, a little bit with the big top tier companies it is. But they're really there to sort of market to the company and to the public and to retailers. It's not like totally a shopping experience. And
right.
This guy just signed contracts on an Aston Martin, $1.3 million Aston Martin hybrid.
Right.
And a $2.7 million Koenigsegg Jesko, which is basically an idea right now. It's not even really a car.
Right. So he won't see something for a few years.
Yeah. Some of these cars won't be out until 2021, 2022. He doesn't know, you know, certainly no one's driving them.
And right.
It's just you're signing an intent to purchase contract.
You mentioned he signed a contract on an Aston Martin. He already had signed a contract, I think, on another one, right?
Yes.
So this is number two.
He's already waiting on one. Yeah. Like there's one coming in the mail that he doesn't even have yet. And then he's getting this other one. And you know, one of the things that we sort of learned through this process is he wants to buy a Bugatti Devo. Mm-hmm. And when he originally saw the Devo, which is their, you know, big current supercar.
Right.
He was like, I'm not sure I'm so into it. So he missed the initial wave and they only make a limited number of these. So he has to convince them
now. He who hesitates.
Yeah. He needs to convince the company to sell one to him. And there's this whole negotiation where they want him to buy another car so he can get it. There's only 50 of them. So it's very funny, this whole dance.
I always wonder too, right? There's a fair amount of wealthy people out there who are into cars. And I do mm-hmm. wonder about these manufacturers of these supercars. Is it, you know, that they've got to have their top customers who get first dibs on everything, right?
Oh, yeah. It's all based on relationships. Again, it's all that kind of negotiation.
They're like back rooms, right? Where everybody's meeting and talking at this thing.
There's like the show booth, which are these big, fabulous booths. And then in the back, there are these VIP rooms where they're kind of really literally wheeling and dealing.
I love it. There's a picture in the section, too, where he's like bending over on, I don't know what kind of car it is, some supercar, and he's like signing his contract.
Yeah, it's a Koenigsegg. And it's like, yeah, the way that you would, you know, buy a Toyota, you know, at the dealer.
Here, let me just sign here on the fender.
Yeah.
All right. So something that may be a little bit more affordable, and that is mm-hmm. crossbody bags. I got to say, I love crossbody bags.
Only a little more.
Hands free. Yeah. Right. It's all relative.
Yeah. You know, the fanny pack trend has been back for a couple of years now, and it's mostly been kind of a fashion people thing.
It's not the fanny packs you wear at the amusement parks.
No,
these
it's
not.
These
are cool ones.
Yeah, these are very cool and can be very expensive. And, you know, it sort of trickled down, as often things do, from the fashion world to sort of everybody else. And I think people were hesitant when it came back. But now all these fashion brands are making really cool ones. And you don't necessarily wear it around your waist. You wear it across your chest. You can wear it on your back. You can wear it over shoulder. And everyone from Dunhill to Dior to Gucci has one. And they range from $700 to $4,000.
Got a favorite here?
You know, I've seen a few of these in person. I think the Dior saddlebag looks very cool, but it's quite small.
Reminiscent of their saddlebag, right? The pocketbook.
It is. Yeah, it is. It's
beautiful.
The same design. It's very chic.
Yeah.
And then I wore the Hermes one, which is, I think, the most expensive one. It's $4,800. And it's huge.
Hermes one?
Yeah. It's almost like a full-size backpack, which you wear it on the front, and it's this ombre kind of neon color. And it's a real statement. Like, I don't think I could pull it off out in the real world, but it's very cool to look at.
I think the Gucci bag, the Madelise bag, that might make it at Coachella. What do you think?
Yes, exactly. That's a little Burning Man right there.
All right. So for more than a decade, so we're going to go from hands-free bags to a cook that probably was definitely using her hands a lot.
Yeah. Oh boy.
This was somebody who was the queen of food journalism. I got mm-hmm. to catch up with Kate Crater, and we talked a little bit about this. She's got a new memoir out.
Yes. So Ruth Reichel was the editor of Gourmet for 10 years. She was an iconic food journalist. And she has yet another memoir, this time specifically about that period of time at Gourmet. And I love her books. And this one's called Saving the Plums. And it's a mix of kind of an exciting Condé Nast, you know, go-go era when the magazine editors had tons of money and, you know, it was very glamorous. And then also, you know, kind of watching the change in public food culture and, you know, what people felt like they were able to accomplish at home, people's relationships with chefs, you know, chefs during that period of time went from people who were kind of in the kitchens you didn't know about to quite public celebrities.
Yeah.
So our relationship with how we get food and our ideas about sustainability and the making of food all really changed a lot during that period of time. And she really helped.
She really made it real, right? Mm-hmm. And not so like anybody could almost do it. And I love that there's, I think, something in the story about she put cupcakes on the cover, right? And that was like such a no-no at Gourmet. Yeah. You don't do that.
Because it's down market or raw fish.
Down
they were
market.
Like, oh gosh, you know, that's going to look gross to people. And of course, I mean, you see sushi on the cover of magazines all the time. Cupcakes, like what? When isn't there a cupcake on the cover of a food magazine? And so, you know, it was fun because Kate Crater, our restaurant editor, was the restaurant
She's
editor.
She's our food queen, I
well,
think.
Well, she was the other queen at this period of time. And she, because she was a restaurant editor at Food & Wine, and she really anointed a lot of these chefs and sort of picked a lot of them out of obscurity and brought them to fame. And so it was interesting to see her kind of talk about this Ruth book and about that period of time.
What's great too, Chris, right? We think about there was a time where not everybody was out there in a cooking show, right? Showing off or putting videos out or doing stuff. I mean, this was a different time.
Which
is why what she said was so important.
Yeah, she hired a video. She was one of the first editors to hire a video producer, which sounds so stupid. I mean, like everybody now, like, oh yeah, what a genius move. But
Take
really, it was very revolutionary, and it really it sort of changed how we think about our kitchens.
That's Pursuit's editor, Chris Rouser.
And that wraps up Bloomberg Business Week's weekend podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jason Kelly.
You know you want one of those supercars.
I do. We can get a matching set.
All right, that's a done deal. I'm Carol Masser. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Radio live Monday through Friday starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time.
Can't catch us live? Get our daily podcast for the ride homes. Download, subscribe at iTunes, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com.
You can get this week's edition of the magazine. It's on newsstands now.
And we'll be back right here next week at the same time.
This is Bloomberg.